Thank you. All lines are now bridged.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the TEFCA Task Force. We have a full agenda today, so we will dive right in. So far of the members, we have John Kinski, Arian Malik, Carolyn Peterson, Cheryl Turney, Sasha Termott, Cynthia Fisher, David McCauley, Mark Savage, and Grace Terrell. Are there any other members that have joined? We'll circle back a little bit later. At this point, I will turn it over to our co-chairs, John and Arian, to get us started.
Hello, good afternoon or morning. Thanks for joining today. The plan is we're going to start off with a overview of the modalities from Alex Contour for about 10 minutes to get that loaded in RAM, and then we want to spend the rest of that hour working through any questions or discussion on modalities, and then we're going to try to manage our time to pick up where we left off on the discussion matrix with individual access services. So with that, if I can, Arian, any modification or addition to that?
Nope. I think one of the things we discovered after the call yesterday is that there was a difference between the definition of directed exchange or targeted query and broadcast query, and then specific sections that talk about the functional requirements. So I think it's probably worthwhile understanding the functional requirements and then how those interact with the definition. So we wanted to make sure that we got a good overview of those topics and then to inform our discussion and recommendations.
Okay. Alex, fire when ready.
All right, real good. Can we get to the first slide? The first of the exchange modality slides. Yes, thank you. Okay, so as Arian mentioned, we did have a long conversation on the last task force meeting about the exchange modalities, but we didn't get into some of the sections of the MRTCs and or QTF where some of the functional obligations for actually performing those modalities are written out and explained. So we just wanted to cover those really quickly today, just to give everybody a little bit of level setting and context about what we mean when we talk about query and broadcast delivery. Just as a reminder to everybody, the MRTCs and the QTF do include functional obligations that relate to intra-QHIN behavior. So again, that's the actions that a QHIN takes to manage these things within its own network. But we have not dictated implementation. So we've not determined what a QHIN must implement or how it must implement these capabilities. The QTF is also a starting point to elicit feedback from the recognized coordinating entity. So any of the standards that you see in there are not meant to be, you know, the final set of standards or specifications that this goes out with eventually. The RCE will have to take on the QTF and make changes as needed. Just as at a very high level, kind of what is our intent between these or for these exchange modalities? Broadcast query is when you don't know where the patient's data is and you're looking for all of the information about that patient that you can get. Targeted query is a more narrow use case. Either you know where you want to obtain data from, or you specifically know a piece of data that you want and you know where it is. Message delivery is for when you care about getting data to a known destination, even if you don't necessarily care about how it gets there. The language describing the obligations for the different entities under TEFCA, so QHINs, participants, and participant members, is generally found in sections 2.2.1 for QHINs, 7.1 for participants, and 8.1 for participant members. And so a lot of what I'll cover comes from those sections. Next slide, please. I've also divided this up between the query functions and the message delivery functions. So if we want to pause after the query sections, just to talk about query. We can do that. If not, let me know and I can continue straight on to message delivery.
We should probably talk about query.
I figured. All right. So I started with the participant member first, just because they have, I guess, the smallest set of obligations. However, you'll see that a lot of the language across all of the different entities is similar, if not the same. And so for the most part, participant members have to do what participants and QHINs have to do. But because they're sort of the theoretical end of the chain, they just have a slightly lighter lift. So we can break down query into, I guess, two components, initiating a query and responding to a query. So for a participant member to initiate a query, it has to be for one of the exchange purposes defined under TEFCA, and that query request has to be, or the query has to be consistent with applicable law. The participant member can initiate a query on its own behalf. So think of like a provider at a provider organization who's looking for data, or it can be on behalf of an individual user for individual access services. So again, that's the use case of getting the patient their data, whether that's through a mobile application, a portal, what have you. In responding to a query, a participant member is required to provide all of the electronic health information in the current US CDI, as long as that electronic health information is available, appropriate and relevant to the specified exchange purpose, permitted under applicable law, and meets the minimum necessary requirements, which were imported from HIPAA. There is a little caveat here where if the participant member is only providing individual access services, they do not need to respond to queries for other purposes. So they would only have to respond to queries for individual access services. And again, since the QTF does not dictate any of the intra-network activities, it does not require participant members to implement any specific standards to handle query. Next slide, please. So participant will look very much the same. To initiate a query, must be for an exchange purpose and must be consistent with applicable law. The participant can initiate a query on its own behalf, in which case it must only look for the minimum necessary information on behalf of a participant member or on behalf of an individual for individual access services. When responding to a query, a participant must request electronic health information from the folks lower down the chain, so from any appropriate participant members, and then it has to transmit those responses back up to the QHIN that asked it of information. It also has to provide, if it stores and maintains any electronic health information, it has to provide any or all electronic health information that it stores or maintains in the current US CDI. And again, that's all electronic health information that is available, appropriate and relevant to the specified exchange purpose, permitted under applicable law, and meets the minimum necessary requirements. As with a participant member, if the participant is only providing individual access services, it does not need to respond to queries for other exchange purposes, only individual access services. And again, like the participant member, it is not required to implement any specific standards under the QTF as currently drafted. Next slide, please. QHINs, so again, to initiate a query, it must be for an exchange purpose and consistent with applicable law. This is the same language that you'll find in all of these sections. It can be initiated by the QHIN on its own behalf, in which case it must meet the minimum necessary requirements on behalf of a participant or on behalf of an individual user for individual access services. So again, very similar to the participant members. When responding to a query, the QHIN must request electronic health information from lower down the chain. So that's the participant in this case, because that's who the QHIN has a relationship with, and then transmit any response it receives to the QHIN that initiated the query. If the QHIN stores or maintains electronic health information, it must provide all of that electronic health information under the current US CDI. Again, if it's available, appropriate and relevant, meets applicable law, and can complies with the minimum necessary requirements. The QN must also deliver the results. So if a QN is broadcasting out, for example, and receives a bunch of information from different other QHINs, it must deliver those results back to the participant or individual user who initially requested the query. Next slide, please. On the technical side of things, we have proposed standards for when QHINs interact with another QHIN. So again, this is the inter-QHIN stuff that's in the QTF. IHE XUA profile, which uses SAML to convey the exchange purpose. IHE XCPD to do patient matching requests and response transactions, and IHE XCA for document discovery and retrieval request and response transactions. There are also some functional requirements where we have not necessarily specified a particular standard. So for example, a QHIN has to be able to accurately resolve requests to match patient demographic information with patient identities under its domain. It must also be capable of locating the records for those patients. And some other functions as needed. A lot of, in most cases, these are really to operationalize the IHE transactions in the event that the QHIN has implemented some other standard or specification within its network, and therefore would need to kind of convert between standards. Also some functional things like making sure that you're asking the appropriate QHIN, the appropriate question. So if it is a targeted query, you know, ask everybody. Obtaining patient demographic information from the query request, obtaining those query parameters, and then just processing all these transactions. There's a few other things in the QTF, but didn't want to just list everything that was there. So I think that covers at a very high level what has to happen for queries. So I'll pause there and open it up for discussion.
Well, I've got a number of questions, but I suspect that David will have his hand raised, which he does.
Sure. First off, that was an excellent summary. I really appreciated the clarity of that. One of the things I think that some of us have gotten tripped up on is the use of the word broadcast, which the way you presented it is a functional requirement, but some of us hear that as a technical means of achieving the functional requirement. So maybe we should make a mental note to keep separate the notion that broadcast is describing the functional expectation that you go find the data elsewhere, but it's not necessarily saying that the way to do that is to broadcast a query to everybody. Because I think some of us think that would not be scalable, the, you know, broadcast the query to everybody. So that's kind of comment number one. And comment number two, again, sort of help me clarify my own confusion, is you have used the term record location to refer to intra-QN requirements, that the QN has to know where the data is. Some of us have used record location as an inter-QN issue, so that instead of having to broadcast, air quotes, to all QHINs, you would use record location knowledge to only request data from QHINs where you know that the patient has data, where the QHINs know amongst themselves where the patient has data. So I'm not offering a suggestion for how to change it, but just to say clarifying the word broadcast is a functional requirement the way you're using it, and the words record location service is an intra-QHIN the way you're using it, even though I think some of us use it as an inter-QHIN. I don't know, does that make sense, Arian? I know you and I have thought about this a lot in prior.
I have a whole bunch of questions along the exactly same lines. I want to go to Mark first because he's in the queue, and then I'll jump in.
Thanks so much, Alex. I want to understand a little bit more about the electronic health information, the USCDI. The way your slides explain it, the requirement, maybe the limitation is the exchange of what's in the US core data for interoperability. EHI, electronic health information, electronic health information is a, the way I use it is generally a broader term. I just want to make sure this is a narrow scope to the U.S. core data for interoperability. That's a minimum requirement. Is that also a limit? Could somebody exchange more?
Right. It is not a limit. It is only the minimum requirement. So everybody's obligated to respond with this standardized data set. You do not have to respond with more, but you can.
Okay. And is there, can you point me to where in the document is the encouragement to exchange more if you have it and can?
I don't believe there's a specific place encouraging that unless you'd find some sort of language in like the TEF portion. But because these are contractual terms, we wouldn't want to necessarily put like encouraging language in. Certainly just want to talk about the obligations.
Okay. Thanks, Aaron. I'd like to flag that as a small issue at some point.
Well, and for me, this is also related to the relationship between the TEFCA and information blocking. You know, under the TEFCA, I've got to potentially only respond with U.S. CDI, and under information blocking, I have different obligations, and aligning those, I think, would be interesting. So I'm going to go back at this question. So first of all, again, thank you for the overview. And you know, I made the mistake of just looking at the definition of targeted exchange and broadcast exchange, and didn't look at the functional requirements. And just as sort of a didactic or explanatory mechanism, I suspect, to David's point, that the terms are actually tripping people up because they map on their own expectation. But I do have a question about the actual terms. So my understanding, when I read the functional requirements, and I think if you can go back, maybe it's this one or the previous slide. So if I look at the functional requirements, if I'm a QHIN who receives a request, it's my obligation to appropriately identify all the sources of data that are responsive to that request. So functionally, I either spray and pray, or I have to implement a record locator service in order to meet the functional requirements. So first of all, let me just pause and make sure I've understood the functional requirements appropriately. If I'm a QHIN and you ask me for data about patient Joe Smith, and I say, well, I don't know any data about patient Joe Smith, but I don't have any functional means of identifying where Joe Smith's data might be in my domain, then I'm not actually responsive to the functional requirements of a QHIN. Do I understand that right?
Hey, Arian, it's Steve. I'm joining you all in Cameo for at least the next 40 minutes. So, this is an area where, given the stage of maturation at which we are along the way in terms of getting the RCE on board, where I'd say, like, largely what you've described seems fair. We've tried to allow for the QINs to optimize their network and how they achieve the QIN kind of functions that we believe a QIN needs to perform, within their hands, perhaps with some guidance from, the RCE et al. In terms of, overall network participation. So maybe getting back to your question, once, if I were a QIN and you were a QIN, if I received a, request from you to find data on Alex, how I go about finding out who among my, in my network has Alex's data, you know, I'm sure you and David and others have many different ideas about how that could be done most efficiently. We weren't at this stage ready to prescribe a particular, you know, one way that that be done. Maybe I'll pause there. Does that help answer your question?
I understand that. I'm really just looking at the functional requirements.
Yeah.
You're not telling me how, but if I don't have any means for identifying where Alex's data might be, and I just respond no, then I'm not really a QHIN. That at least functionally, as part of a QHIN, I've got to have the means to identify where Alex's data might be amongst my participant members and participants. To do the job of a QHIN.
Well, I mean, there's an alternative, I suppose, you know, just to play it out in a hypothetical would be that, let's say I'm more of a thinner client QHIN, and I impose that obligation on my participants, where I would say, you know, I'm, you know, you three participants, go find me this data.
Right.
And that's maybe that's a hybrid between your spray and pray and having something more optimized and record locating.
Right. Exactly. So I'm not presupposing that a literal record locator is functionally required. But if I don't have a literal record locator, I do have to have the means to delegate that responsibility downwards, whether that's through spray and pray or through, in your example, maybe I'm a federation of a bunch of local HIEs and I go ask the local HIEs. But if I don't do that activity, that I'm not meeting the functional requirements of a QHIN.
Yeah, I think Alex and I are shaking our heads. I mean, that seems fair, and I think we are at the point where that kind of functional responsibility, let's call it, could be more prescriptive over time as the RCE comes on board and, you know, multiple other, you know, actors in the field get involved in what the MRTCs and QHIN technical framework requirements should be.
Yep.
You know, things could lean one way or the other, or it could be more open-ended as you described, so long as when you send me a query, I can respond back to you, and you don't really care how I got how I got it done under the hood.
Yep. And then notwithstanding that I think that the term targeted query and broadcast care query are confusing as defined, I read an obligation under targeted query to go ask the QHINs that I believe have the patient's data, but I don't read an obligation to identify particularly the participant or participant member who does or doesn't have that data. Do I have that understood correctly? The definitional difference between targeted query and broadcast query in the MRTCs is that targeted query asks one or some subset of QHINs and broadcast query asks all QHINs. And then I just read to me that, so here record location, so maybe it was a different one, but if I do a targeted query, then I've got to have the means of identifying which QHIN I go ask. But I don't, as I said, I don't read the functional requirement to identify the participant or participant member. And maybe I've got that wrong.
Right. So in the short definition for these things, you won't see those functional requirements. But if you do look in the specific provisions that we just discussed, 2.2.1, 7.1, there is an obligation to request electronic health information from appropriate participants or participant members, whichever it is.
Okay. And again, I think this is an area where I may be getting tripped up over the difference between targeted query and broadcast query. In a situation
maybe to help you out here. I mean, I think there are, as we all experience, there are only so many terms that exist in the universe unless pride yourselves on creating, you know, new acronyms for people to memorize. If broadcast query and targeted query don't work for folks, I would encourage you to use the words or not to say that you should not longer use descriptions, but I think to your point, what you were getting at, Arian, right? So when we consider targeted query, we are talking about that subset. And of that subset, you know who you want to ask. You want to ask data from them, you know, from which you want to ask data. On the interactions that we would expect to occur from a broadcast query would be the, I have a patient that's shown up, and I don't know where their data is, and I hope that the network can enlighten me.
Yeah.
For lack of a better description.
So there's a couple of hands up, but this is John, and I'm going to sneak in a quick question on this one. So sorry if it's a dumb one. So if a QHIN, I understand exactly what you just said, Steve. If a QHIN gets a query, does from another QHIN, does it know if it's a broadcast query or a targeted query?
We're shaking our head no. Given the we relied on the IHE profiles, I do not believe there's any specific way to distinguish those in those transactions, and therefore the QHIN is just responding to a query, and that's part of why you don't see these obligations broken out by targeted or broadcast, and you see words like appropriate or applicable.
Yeah,
but a QHIN receiving a and now I sound like I'm answering my own question. If it's a query from somebody who knows where the data is, it's going to say, "Hi, here's my query, and I need data from Bob's medical center on this patient." And if it's a broadcast query, it's going to say, "Hi, I just need information on this patient if you have it."
Yeah. So the context may be implicit, right? For the receiving, the receiving QHIN of the query.
So you'll be able to infer. It's not different in that it's labeled broadcast or targeted. It's different in that one would be able to infer. Thank you.
Yeah, and I have a similar line, maybe last line of questioning before we go to the other folks who've patiently got their hands raised. Although when I started, nobody had their hands raised. There's an intermediate mode that seems to me to be reasonable, where I cache locations, including separate network locations of data, and I don't remember the actual specific participant or participant members. I just remember the QHINs that I'm supposed to go query. And also remember the QHINs where I didn't get any data. And then as an optimization method, I might go ask just those QHINs the next time for their data. And I think that's a neither fish nor fowl in the definition that you've proposed. By definition, it's not broadcast query because I'm not literally asking every QHIN. But by definition, it's not targeted query because I don't identify the location of participant or participant members.
So
to John's point,
definitionally, targeted query is the complicating factor here, right, is that we've got this sort of tree structure of networks. And if you look at sort of the space that we're playing in, we're really just talking about at the QHIN level in a lot of these cases. So, like, the targeted query definition has nothing to do with participants and participant members. It's literally asking a question of another QHIN, and then that QHIN is obligated to go and do certain things to get the data from within its network, from its participants and participant members. So a broadcast query, I think one of the things we're kind of dancing around here is not that every node in every network needs to be queried. It's that all of the QHINs need to be queried, and then they need to figure out where the appropriate data lies and get that back to the initiating QHIN. Or I would, just piggyback on Alex's point, this is kind of where you're going, Arian, is that there may be a kind of layer in the middle there where over time QHINs become more intelligent.
Yep.
And that would be a flexibility that I would say the RCE should discuss, or would be in the position to help orchestrate to determine kind of that intermediate mode that you're discussing where, I've done 1,000 queries and I have a good sense of what the network topology looks like and, that this is how I want to, get the data back as efficiently as possible.
Okay. Thank you. Super helpful. Laura and then David.
Hi, it's Laura. Thanks. I just wanted to circle back just a minute. I'm sorry, jumped into this other topic, back on the US CDI question of being minimum, and try just ask a clarifying question based on the appropriate and applicables. At times, it might be less than the US CDI if the request didn't meet minimum necessary or applicable law. Am I interpreting that correct based on the language on the slides?
Correct.
Okay, thanks.
And the language also accommodates, Laura, for instances where you don't have that data available generally, depending on who the, kind of that endpoint is.
Right, and I think Mark was asking the question, the opposite of that question, so I think these are important distinctions. I think Mark was asking the opposite of that question is that if I ask, for example, on behalf of a patient via patient access, almost by definition, there's no minimum necessary, and the bound of data that I might be asking for might be broader than the US CDI. Likewise, if I ask for, a population health mechanism and social determinants of health or activities of daily living or otherwise are contained in unstructured documents, it might be appropriate for the respondent to surface up those unstructured documents. And Mark, I think, was asking whether that was permitted or allowed, and I think the answer is yes. And it's actually required. It's actually required in relative to information blocking, which is, I think, maybe some of the recommendations we might want to consider. David.
So, I've got a long list of things I'd love to talk about. I'll try to be parsimonious here. One high-level thing is I found it very useful in Alex's presentation to distinguish between inter and intra from QHIN responsibilities. And, Arian, when you asked your question, it wasn't clear to me sometimes whether you were talking about inter or intra. So that abstraction of the QHIN, representing to the outside world a group of participants and their obligations to the outside world is useful, but we just should be careful to distinguish, is this the QHIN responding to another QHIN, or is this the QHIN acting on behalf of an internal obligation to its participants reaching outward? So inter and intra is an important distinction to keep in mind there. That's number one. Number two, I'm really happy to hear the notion of these abstractions are being deferred for technical details to the RCE. I think, you can tell from the complexity of this conversation that that's the only way you're going to get a really robust implementation is to have stakeholders with deep understanding hash out all those gory details. So I commend you on that. I think some of us have the concern that this is kind of my point three, that one of the ways systems are being used today, at least in the company where I used to work, is for every patient in an ambulatory setting, before the patient shows up, a query is done to the network to fetch the federated record, which is then internally processed and matched against what's known about the patient in the local EHR, and then the clinician gets a display of, here's new stuff you may not know about, here's stuff that's happened since the last visit, however they want to fetch it. But the net is every patient encounter, or at least a high percentage of patient encounters, could in fact generate these queries that need to go to every other QHIN, because you don't know where the patient's been since they were in last. You haven't even talked to the patient yet. This is all getting triggered in a midnight run based on the clinic schedule. So the concern from a technical point of view about broadcast is that you could, in a sense, have every QHIN responding to every patient visit in the country every time a patient visit occurs, and that would get really difficult. I think, Arian, you calculated out some quadrillion transactions or something that would result in. I think that's why the concern is about this notion of broadcast. What do you mean? And you're not telling us how to solve that scaling problem, but just that you need to solve it. The RCE needs to solve it.
Yeah, and by the way, just David, to your first point, I get confused and got confused in Alex's presentation about whether participants and participant members are leaky out of the boundaries of the QHIN relative to targeted query, whether QHINs effectively provide an abstraction boundary that says you don't even know what general hospital is. You just ask me and I go figure it out.
That's a hugely important distinction. I mean, I think, Steve, that care quality today, to take one example of a targeted query implementation, would bypass the QHIN because the address of the target is known from the dictionary, from the directory. So this proposal that you've got on the table would change that and say, you have to go through a QHIN, and I'm not sure that's a good idea. I don't know. I think that's a technical detail that's important, but maybe beyond this conversation.
All right. I do not see any other folks with their hands raised. Let me see if I can pull the sense of the task force, which is I believe that there is a sense of relief relative to the MRTCs and the functional obligations of and better understanding the functional obligations of QHINs. There is still some confusion relative to the obligations under, quote, targeted query, unquote, and, quote, broadcast query, unquote. In particular, how leaky the QHIN is relative to directory services and identifying participant members and participants, obligation under targeted query, and then I think a general comment that it might be more useful to drop the distinction of targeted and broadcast and simply require a QHIN who's doing a query to query if the QHIN knows that. Anyway, I could drive some solutions, but I won't. But maybe some confusion around the use of targeted query and broadcast query, and it may be better just to put the QHIN's functional requirements front and center, and defer some of these distinctions of targeted broadcast when I query, who I query, at what time relative to QHIN to QHIN status. So I think that's the sense of the task force. In terms of the reaction to the presentation, some of the questions associated with the presentation, I'm just going to pause to make sure that there aren't other. And then I think there's we had a reasonable discussion about USCDI obligations to minimize data relative to USCDI, obligations to maximize data relative to USCDI. And the link between the TEF and information blocking, in particular relative to obligations under USCDI. So I think those are the key discussion topics that might inform recommendations. I'm going to pause to make sure that I haven't missed anything. And on cue, there's David.
I think this is a question that we touched on way back, and I don't think it's a technical question, but it's a policy question, just to not forget about the asymmetry that is permitted for participants acting on behalf of individuals that they can query but don't have to respond. I think there's some open questions there that I would just queue up for downstream, maybe. That got mentioned briefly in Alex's presentation. Arian, does that make sense? We talked about, for example, if you were a PHR kind of service and you wanted to respond for certain kinds of a direct treatment, were you allowed to? If you responded to some of them, do you have to respond to all of them? Is it legal to be a suck completely and never respond to anything but just consume? There were some of those questions I think we raised earlier.
Got it. Yeah, relative to participant and participant member obligations. I think we understand that QHINs are obligated to do all the things.
Yeah, it's the IAS subset.
And the IAS subset, just to restate, is relative to participant and participant member obligations, not relevant to QHIN obligations. Because I think that's been a point
right.
that I've been confused on in the past. Okie doke.
Yeah, there's nothing that would stop a single participant QHIN from getting created under the current rules, though. So,
yeah, but if you're a QHIN, then you're under the QHIN obligations, and you're expected to respond
yeah.
to everything. Whereas if you're a participant or participant member, so it would be funny, right? I think maybe you're hypothesizing a QHIN that's the outer boundary and a participant member that's the inner boundary. And the QHIN has to ask for everything, and the participant member basically doesn't respond to anything except for IAS queries.
Right.
Yeah. We're hackers at heart, and so we're always thinking about how do you break the rules.
Speak for yourself.
Some of us are thinking constantly about how you break the rules. All right. I see no more questions in the queue, so maybe, John, I get to delegate over to you, and we get to deal with, I think we're going to IAS.
Message delivery.
Oh, message.
Thank you.
We forgot message delivery, of course. Let's talk about message delivery.
All right, this should be pretty quick because, again, a lot of this is very similar to what we saw in the query side. Participant members. To initiate message delivery, again, must be for an exchange purpose and consistent with applicable law. The participant member can initiate a message delivery on its own behalf, in which case it must meet the minimum necessary requirements, or on behalf of an individual user for individual access services. When delivering a message, the participant member must send the electronic health information to the appropriate individual user, and must return an automated response to the participant. So whether that is the response generated by the individual user or the participant member generating a response if the message was delivered to the participant member, that all has to flow back up to the participant. We will note that the data being able to be, or data being exchanged under message delivery is not limited to the USCDI data set. So we are talking about all electronic health information in this case. And again, participant members are not required to implement any specific standards under the QTF as it's currently written. Next slide. Participant, very similar to participant member, initiating a message delivery, again, must be for an exchange purpose and consistent with applicable law. Participant can initiate it on its own behalf, meeting the minimum necessary obligations, on behalf of a participant member, or on behalf of an individual user for individual access services. Delivery response, again, sending the electronic health information to the appropriate entity, whether that's a participant member or individual user, and then returning those automated responses back up to the QHIN. Again, not required to implement any specific standards by the QTF. Next slide. QHINs, again, initiate delivery for an exchange purpose and consistent with applicable law. They can do it themselves, they can do it on behalf of a participant, or they can do it on behalf of an individual user. If they do it themselves, they have to meet the minimum necessary obligations. They must send, when they receive a request for message delivery, they have to send the electronic health information to the appropriate participant or individual user, and return an automated response back to the QHIN that requested that delivery. They must also return automated responses that they've received to the participant or individual user that is the end of the chain, so to speak, for that message delivery, just so that the participant and individual user would, for example, know that their message has been received. Next slide. So on the technical side, again, we've got IHE XUA using SAML to convey exchange purpose. This is the inter-QHIN activities, and IHE XCDR for the actual message delivery transactions. Internally, QHIN's functional requirements include patient identity resolution. I believe there's something in the XCDR or XDR spec, which it's based on, that talks about patient matching the data that you're sending, And then there's other functions, again, similar to operationalizing these IHE transactions, such as determining who you're going to send the message to, what other QHINs, actually obtaining the documents and metadata from the entity that's requesting you to send a message, and processing all these transactions.
Before I let David in, I've got one question which just relates to whether participant and participant members are leaky out of QHINs. And I think so far proposed they are not, which leads me to believe that I get a message as a QHIN from a participant or participant member. It's my responsibility to figure out the one and only one other QHIN that I should send that message to, with any other metadata that I might have that might have, you know, some information on location it should be sent to, but that's I don't have any obligation to maintain that in any structured form. And then the obligation of the receiving QHIN is to take a message delivery and figure out what to do with it, where figure out what to do with it involves, I think, sending it to the appropriate participant or participant member, or I would assume also throwing my hands up and sending back a I can't deliver this message. So first of all, this is where I get confused between the QHIN to QHIN boundary and the participant to participant boundary. Am I thinking about this the right way, just thinking about QHINs and as an abstraction that don't expose necessarily participants or participant members in a structured way? And so as a QHIN, when I get a message delivery message, I'm obligated to figure out what QHIN to send it to that QHIN, and then obligated to deliver the message receipt back, and that's the extent of my obligations. Am I understanding that correctly? And then as a receiver, I'm obligated to figure out which participant or participant member to send it down to, and not necessarily bound by what was in the address or addressing information that I received. So do I understand that correctly?
This is Steve. So maybe I'll chime in here, and Alex can always correct me. So and this gets to perhaps you and David were having a mind meld on what you view as the type of leakage that's occurring, which might be helpful to clarify for everybody else. I think you can tease that out in a part as I react to your reactions, Arian. So often when I torture Zoe and Alex about this, I write on my whiteboard who and how. And when you know who you want to send it to and how to send it, you don't need Tefka, you don't need QHINs. And so if you have an existing method that works for you to send data from point A to point B, and you know how to do it and you know who to send it to, then you can use whatever you want. If you choose, let's fast forward, and if all this network infrastructure is fully created and operational, if you choose to use the QHIN exchange network, as we kind of colloquially describe it, because that's just part of your workflow and it's easier, then by all means, go ahead and do that. But in instances where you know who you want to send it to, but you don't know how, that's where we envisioned at least one role for this QHIN to QHIN interaction to occur. And there's a lot of kind of built-in functions, that we already explored with Query that would be reused to help QHINs process message delivery across, right? So, like, I don't know how to get you the data that I want to send you, Arian, but I have a QHIN, so I'm going to send them the data, and I'm going to say, figure it out. Get this data over to Arian. Use the power of the network. Here's who I want you to send it to. Does that help?
Yeah. So just to use an example, I might form a QHIN for the purposes of public health, and that QHIN might know all the intricacies of how each state wants to receive its data, and the other QHIN that receives a message for public health says, hey, I'm just going to go send it over to the public health QHIN and let the public health QHIN figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, that would certainly be a plausible approach. I mean, you could definitely extrapolate your point to other
right.
scenarios as well. You know, yours is more of kind of a specialized QHIN. But yeah, I mean, there could be other instances where, let's say there's I'll pick on myself, right? Let's say there's a federal QHIN, and everyone just knows if there's a federal agency that is the destination of your data, then you send it, you know, the other QHINs know to send it to the, you know, shoot it over to the federal QHIN, they'll figure it out.
Yeah, so if I send it to VA if I send a referral report, response report back to VA, I just go send it to VA and VA figures out where it goes. I'm struggling a little bit over the who and how, so I think you said that the functional use case for message delivery is I know who, but I don't know how. But I think I know who in the sense of what QHIN, but I don't know who in the sense of what organization, at least not in a structured way. I might say this should go to hospital XYZ, but I don't have the web services endpoint that's the actual who relative to technical delivery. That's a QHIN.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, you as a sender wouldn't have all of that detail, but you would say, I'm referring this patient to, you know, cardiologist Dr. Joe. And I would send that up to my QHIN, and then my QHIN would just take care of it for me. I'm sorry to make it so oversimplified, but like I would give them the requisite addressing information for them to identify what QHIN Dr. Joe is a part of, and then my QHIN would get it to Dr. Joe's QHIN, and Dr. Joe's QHIN would get, you know, him the data, however, you know, that intra QHIN stuff works, and you know, that would be not prescribed per se, so they could use any type of transactional, you know, flow that they so choose to use.
Yep. Okay.
Let me jump in there. It's because you moved my cheese a little bit. So I know who I want it to send. I know who I want to send the message to, but I don't know how. So I send it to my QHIN. But it turns out that the person that I want to send it to is not participating in the TEFCA ecosystem. That could happen, right?
Sure. And you know, that would be unfortunate, you know, to say, give me their number. No, you know, that would be that's certainly a risk with any network, right? You know, there were people that weren't on Prodigy when I was on Prodigy and wanted to send my, you know, an email to them on some other, you know, network, for anyone who wants a tech throwback Tuesday. But you know, as you know, provided there's a sufficient amount of participation, our hope would be over time that would occur less frequently. But certainly, there could be pockets of you know, the U.S. let's say that would not be part of it. And you know, as I got back to earlier, there are certainly other transactional approaches that exist today to do. And I don't want folks to get hung up on message delivery and interpretation of what message is. It's like, we could just call it data delivery. You know the destination that you want to send the data, just like, I want to send you a package. I want to send Arian a package. Here's the information that I, you know, want to send him. It could get put on the back of a bike courier, then get tossed in a truck, then get put on a plane, then get put on the back of, you know, an alpaca, and it makes it to Arian, right? I don't know how it got there, but it did. And that's kind of the beauty of the network. And I'm sorry I'm being a little colloquial, but, you know, hopefully that helps, you know, with the conversation.
Got it. Okay, so we got David, Mark, Roche, and Sasha, who all have their hands up. And Sasha's asking the same question that I was going to ask and follow up, so I will refrain from asking that and follow up. Go through that in order, and I think we want to get to individual access at the top of the hour, which gives us 4 minutes to get through some of these questions, which I suspect we'll go a little bit over. But we'll try to time limit and make sure that we do our usual go broad before we go deep. This is our first pass deep. David.
Yeah, so I think it's well known that I think this is a disastrous part of the TEFCA proposal, because we already have a network that accomplishes these goals, as well as these requirements would accomplish those goals. And so I can go deep on that, but we don't have time. But I will say, and this direct, obviously, so if you substituted HISP for QHIN, then direct meets all of these requirements today. It's hard for me to see how this would be any better than what we have with direct. And it's very easy for me to see how it could create chaos, because, you know, OR means AND to the vendor community. If one has to offer both choices, then the vendors have to do the double work. And now it's going to get really confusing as to how to get messages from one place to another. And they'll probably just drop back to the good old fax machine, because they understand how that works. A more subtle point, which may be a more relevant point, both for direct and for this proposal, is if you're going to send patient information to some other place, you better know where it's going and who's going to get it, or you're in breach, which is a big deal. So that means the directories that you will consult when you pick your target have to correspond to an entity prepared to receive the information. And if the entity is prepared to receive the information, then the directory can contain sufficient information to get it to them. That's how direct works. And the big problem with direct has been a lot of providers aren't willing to expose an inbox, an open-ended inbox, because they don't know what that'll do to them, to their workflow, to, you know, the staff required to man it and distribute it internally and take responsibility for follow-up, et cetera. This doesn't solve that problem, right? You can't be in the directory unless you have a dedicated system prepared to respond to inbound patient information coming in. Otherwise, you're creating a breach opportunity every time somebody pushes up to the QHIN and says, get it to them, please. You have no idea where it'll go. So sorry for the rant. I feel strongly about this one.
All right. We're going to go to Mark Roche and then Sasha.
Hi. This may be an addition to the question that's just been asked. Does TEFCA plan to provide a centralized directory of all the participating providers and healthcare institutions, so that if I'm a provider practicing in Hospital A, I know which hospitals and providers are covered within TEFCA network and which ones are not?
So I'm gonna take a first pass response to that, which is that directory services are not one of the TEFCA obligations. There's no obligation, as far as I understand, for a QHIN to publish its own directory of endpoints, which is why I think this discussion of message delivery ends up being, hey, other network, I'm getting you this thing, and I'm giving you as much information as I got, and it's your responsibility to deliver it to the endpoint, but we don't actually have a directory that exposes endpoints. I'm just going to pause there to make sure I understand that. And maybe, Sasha, I'll let you ask your question, because I think it's a similar one.
Yeah, so I guess I was responding to some of the earlier description about if you know who you want to send to but not how to send there, then presumably you don't have something like a direct address. And I was just trying to understand if the sort of necessary amount of information for addressing uniquely is something that is standardized or left to each QHIN to determine. Because I was trying to parse through how one QHIN would communicate with another with non-standardized amounts of information for uniquely identifying recipients.
Yeah, so this is Steve. Maybe I'll pick it up here. So this is an area that was a change since the last, or I should say a transactional context that changed since the last version of the kind of TEFCA documents that we put out. And that was in response to public comment. So as David knows, you know, and all of you are well aware, ONC has been a participant, supporter, et cetera, of direct related transactions, part of certification. And, you know, all that considered, we still receive considerable feedback from a portion of the community that they didn't feel like the Trust Exchange Framework Common Agreement would sufficiently represent their interest if it didn't include some way of using the network to make, you know, point-to-point transactions, you know, a reality. And so that was our interest in including that. And there are some issues, as you all are rightfully pointing out, that will need to be solved both from a policy component, you know, aspect, which I would say is a little bit simpler than the query side. But on the technical side, you know, to not make matters worse, and I think that's there's definitely a value proposition question and perhaps a broader part of the community that either needs to, you know, fully consider and be part of existing exchange mechanisms, or that the community that's putting forward the existing exchange mechanisms to better understand why the folks that wanted message delivery as part of this work, why their needs were currently unmet, and that they suggested to us, you know, that it would be important to include in the, you know, QN technical framework and MRTCs. But back to Sasha's point, and I think it's piggybacking on Arian's, there are certainly a few other technical issues that would need to be resolved. And again, not that we were deferring, you know, everything, but we wanted to set up kind of the structure and the skeleton for the RCE to take the subsequent feedback that we'd received during this time period and start to wrestle with how to either improve on existing services or make something that would work among QNs that could be more specialized or solve particular use cases. Those are certain avenues that could still be pursued by the RCE.
Okay, David, one more question you get, and then we swap it over. You get to the last
word.
Yeah,
just a suggestion to Steve, or to the team, actually to the TEF team, is independent of this work group. I think it would be really good idea for you guys to talk to Scott Stewie or someone else who represents Direct Trust about some of the use cases that you're trying to address, the ones that came up. Because they've wrestled with all of those, and they can tell you what makes them hard or what the issues are. And as usual, they aren't technical issues. they aren't going to be solved by a new technology. So just be sure you get input from them. I assume you have already, but I had a recent conversation with Scott about public health concern, and Noam has agreed to meet with him and some of the Direct Trust members who are serving the public health entity in certain states, to make sure they understand what is possible and doable with technologies that we have today. So just be sure you get their input before you go into final mode.
Yeah, no, much appreciated, David. And I would say you definitely kind of touched on, you know, one stakeholder group that was more vocal than others about the need for message delivery to be part of this Trusted Exchange Framework ecosystem.
Yeah, that is underway in public health for sure, and it may not be widely understood, so behooves to learn about it, I think.
All right, so I'm going to turn it over to John. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's John. While we still have Steve, and before he drops, I wanted to see if I could sneak in.
Steve just left the room. Sorry.
Is he gone?
Yep.
Dang, that guy's quick. So let me maybe someone else from it's not a Steve specific question. I was just going to put the hot lights on him for a second. Maybe somebody else from ONC can take this one. It gets to the broad question that we started with of kind of the overall purpose and policy goals of TEFCA. So I understood Steve to say on the one hand, don't use the QHAND Exchange Network if you have another way to achieve your messaging goals. Are you talking specific to a message transaction? I know who I want to send it to. I know how I can send it to them. I don't necessarily need to use my QHIN. On the other hand, when I brought up a physician or a provider or whatever somewhere who might not be participating in the TEFCA ecosystem, his reaction was, well, gosh, I hope there aren't many people who aren't part of the TEFCA ecosystem. So it's not necessarily a contradiction, but I'm trying to develop my instincts on how we envision the QHIN Exchange Network being used when there are other means that exist in the world for just about all these exchange purposes. If anyone can comment.
I think I would respond to that just by thinking about the, I guess, congressionally mandated purpose behind this. So that is, you know, focused really on this network-to-network level. And being cognizant of the fact that there is a lot of stuff out there that currently works, but that it still remains siloed. So we don't want to necessarily disrupt what exists out there, but we do want to make sure that what exists out there can talk to the other entities, organizations, groups that are trying to do the same thing. So it's kind of walking a fine line where, you know, we want as many people to participate in the TEFCA as possible because we think that'll get us to fuller at-scale interoperability than if they didn't. But at the same time, we're not saying that TEFCA is the only mechanism through which all, you know, interoperability, health information technology transactions should be run.
Thanks. For the record, I'm struggling with my developing my intuition because on the one hand, it seems like ONC isn't trying to view TEFCA, QHIN Exchange Network as the backup network. If you can't do it via what you usually do, try the QHIN. Yet at the same time, I heard, and it seems appropriate, that we want the QHIN Exchange Network to not disrupt those means that exist today. So struggling to wrap my head around how that's going to play out in reality.
And maybe a finer point to put on it is that you would essentially be using that they would be well integrated and symbiotic existing networks in the TEFCA network, so that you're not necessarily having to follow two different workflows depending on what you get back from one or the other. Rather, networks join and TEFCA is as well enough aligned with their regular workflows and operations that it doesn't require them to do significantly more to be able to do TEFCA transactions as they do their regular business. That makes sense.
Yeah, so I think this will form potentially part of the comments that we would offer up. I want to make sure that we get time to start IAS.
Yep.
And hey, Zoe, do you mind zooming in on the document, making it a little larger, please?
Thank you. That was my question as well.
Yep. Is that better? Yep.
Yes. Okay. So we are returning to, for those of you that have slept at least once over the weekend, or those who missed the last call, what we have in front of you is the matrix of questions that or discussion items that we captured in previous calls. They're tiered, and we're kind of in the home stretch of the top tier with individual access services. And let's see how far we can push through the bottom of the list today and capture notes, and everybody can see what we're looking at. We're on IAS. Just looking at some of the things, the definition of IAS, it's in the beginning of the MRTCs, on page on my copy it's 35, but I know there's anyway, it's in the list of definitions, and I was wondering if anybody recalls, is there confusion over the definition of AIS? I know there were certainly bullets a couple down lower where we want to talk about who has to respond to queries for IAS, and then I had some questions myself that came up earlier. I think David brought them up about, or someone did, about IAS-only providers. So I'll take a breath. Does anyone have a specific question or topic about the definition of IAS that was up for discussion?
This is Mark. I raised that the way it's defined, it limits the everything about what the individual does to a right to exercising a right to access under the HIPAA privacy rule, or getting a copy, directing that a copy be transmitted to a third party, when there are a whole host of other purposes for which an individual might want to use a trusted exchange framework. Patient-generated health data was one of the examples that I mentioned, but shared care planning is something that the Fire at Scale Task Force is also working on. Those are all things where patients are participating, doing things. It's not just about exercising their right to access a copy or to transmit a copy to somebody else. So I framed it around the definition, because the definition is actually what constricts the exchange purpose for both pushing and pulling.
So is there any, so you're suggesting there isn't ambiguity in the definition, but you're suggesting that the definition constrains, you're pointing out that it leaves out certain potential, I guess I'll say exchange purposes, if that's not a misuse of the term, for individuals.
Well, I think, I don't remember if we got this clarity on the last call, but it may be good to just ask and level set, is that an intended constraint? That's the way I read it. If that's not intended, then it is an ambiguity. If it is intended, then
got it.
Not an ambiguity.
Mm-hmm. Someone from ONC can, yes, thank you.
Sure, yeah, and the individual access services, the definition is specific to the right to access and obtain the copy, and then, of course, to send it to a third party, but it is constricted to access and obtain.
Thank you. I've discovered it's impossible to facilitate these calls and take any notes whatsoever at the same time, so I'm going to rely on others. Okay, so the patient-generated healthcare data, should IAS include the ability for, we just answered that question, correct? That is not intended to be part of the in part of the definition as written.
The way I think about it is IAS is access only, and it's read only, as defined.
So this is Mark. I think there are some core use cases that actually go beyond that, and so I'm raising the question because I think we're missing an opportunity if we keep it constrained the way it is currently. However, you want to tee that up as a discussion topic.
Well, I think we're there now. So you offered a couple of examples of use cases that appear to be outside the definition. So do you want to expound on that, or is your suggestion that, well, they shouldn't be?
Yeah, I don't think something as basic as an individual participating in shared care planning should be outside the scope of TEFCA. So we're designing something like that, as I said, in the FAST task force, and I think we're building something that's not only for the present but also for the future. We should be building in some broader capability for patients and individuals than just exercising your right of access. we're building that in more broadly for providers and for payers. This is not a big on ramp for some and a small on ramp for others.
Not as someone who is not familiar with what shared care planning looks like or how it plays out, are there obstacles to, I mean, given the exchange purposes and standards that we're proposing, is this a big step outside the box that Mark is suggesting, or is it eminently doable?
That's quite a range. I'd like to think it's eminently doable, but I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, I don't know the answer. I don't see any hands up. Oh, yes, I do. David McCauley. Oh. Thank you, David.
Yeah, you can count on me. So, first off, I understand Mark's concern that it might be too limited. On the other hand, I think that it would be a major hurdle and major success if TEFCA could fulfill the read-only notion that is being described. And I would suggest, you know, walk first, run later. You know, that presumably the RCE amongst the stakeholders could expand the capabilities over time, but this notion that an individual should have a simple way to accumulate all of their personal health data, all of their provider-managed health data that the TEFCA could provide as envisioned here is a huge step forward compared to where we are today, where you have to connect with each patient portal one by one, and remember which ones you have and have massive numbers of passwords and all that stuff that just is very it's too much of a friction for most consumers. But so I think this is really good. I go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if I take off my chair's hat and make my comment, I was going to say that that's pretty much how I would have summarized. This is great. This is great progress and a big leap forward. I can tell you that I learned during the information blocking task force that there are plenty of folks in Mark's camp as well.
Oh, yeah. No, I think Mark's goals are admirable. I think it's just extraordinarily complex to envision an entity that would take on that responsibility. I think it's way beyond what's being envisioned for the modestly funded RCE. But anyway, so be that as it may, I want to put two edge test cases on the table just to get, I think we've brought these up before, but to get reactions as to whether they would be allowed or not. And, you know, one IAS edge case would be a consume-only participant, which, you know, is an entity that could recruit consumers and say, give us your permission, we'll go gather all of your healthcare data, and we'll monetize it with you or for you, or we'll just monetize it and give you some freebie in exchange. And is that, would that be allowed, consume only? I think the way it's currently written, that would be. And then sort of the inverse of that is a health record bank model, where an entity would join the network and say, give us permission, we'll fetch all your data, we'll organize it into a coherent medical record, dedupe it, give you the ability to annotate it, et cetera, and then allow you to share it back with the same TEFCA network to other providers, which would now, you know, involve a limited subset of the permitted purposes that node would want to be offering, and would that be allowed? You know, sort of the consume only and monetize it is case one, and then the health record bank case two. Are those both permitted?
So let's take it one at a time. Is there the opportunity? Is it legal? Is it kosher? Is it okay for an IAS participant to only pull data and not respond to IAS queries? I wanted to say I thought that one was answered, and I thought that they had to respond for IAS. Can ONC help us out?
Yes, confirmed.
Okay, so you can't if you're IAS, you can be IAS only as a participant on the network, but you have to respond as well as query, is what you just said, Zoe, right?
Yes, and you have to respond to the data you have available.
But only to IAS, right?
Correct.
If you're only doing IAS services, then you only have to respond to IAS. But if you have other services and you're offering treatment and quality assessment and improvement, then you have to respond to all queries.
Yeah, so that's kind of a no-op in a sense that if I'm an individual and I've granted this participant the ability to go fetch my entire record, then I'm the only one who could access somebody else to come get it out of that participant. And I guess if I wanted to migrate my PHR to another vendor, that would be a use case that would work. But it's pretty narrow. But anyway, the basic answer is yes, that's allowed, sort of a consume only.
But and then, I want to explore that. Let's not let go of that one just yet because I want to make sure I understand something. So is it plausible that an app vendor who's a participant in the network, can they get that blanket? I'm thinking about the IAS, the limited rights that we have given the patient. Can that be sort of automated where the is that allowable for the patient to the consumer to say to their chosen app vendor who's a participant on the network, hey, yeah, I'll click this box that says you can go get any and all of my data that you can find because it's for this permitted exchange purpose. That seemed to be implied in David's example, and I'm wondering if there's anything that prevents that from happening.
I'm not sure I completely understand the distinction in the example, but I believe that would be allowed, and then if the individual or the service wanted to then, you know, take the data and, you know, allow the patient to modify it or do something else with it, they would just need the patient's approval after receipt of the minimum information, and then they can do whatever they want with it, and then the individual would be able to direct that data be sent to a third party as part of the exchange purposes if they wanted to. Does that make sense?
It does, I'll be colloquial in the example of channel my inner Steve Posnack. Is I guess when I think of IAS, I think of there's this consumer and they're going to have an appointment with a specialist they've never seen before. So they use their individual access services to pull their data from their primary care physician, and they direct it to their specialist in preparation for that appointment. That seems super obvious. What I hadn't contemplated is I'm a consumer. I sign up with this app that sounds like a good place an app that has good functionality for me to access and control my data. But what really happens is that service ends up just saying, hey, just give me your rights to shoot queries around the network and gather your data. It has to be, I understand, for exchange purposes that are permitted. So I'm not sure whether what I'm suggesting is sensical or nonsensical.
No, it doesn't have to be for an exchange purpose. Is consumer says, go get my record. That is the exchange purpose, right? You could give that app, that third party app, your proxy to go get your record, and that's all they need. They can get all your data. That's the whole point of IAS, as I hear it.
Doesn't have to be triggered by an encounter or a reason or anything.
Nope.
Okay.
You know, and the concern that raises, well, the good use case for that, the one that I think we all hope emerges, is something like exactly your use case of pulling down your data, consolidating it into a record so that your specialist has a well-organized record to browse when they see you. That's the health record bank kind of model. perfidious case or perverse case is, let's say, you know, a placement agency convinces you that if you give them access to your health data, they can convince employers that you're healthier than average and that you should go to the top of the job queue. And oh, by the way, if your health data is not so good looking, then maybe you'll never get a job again. That would be also a permitted purpose because the consumer access, you know, permitted the data to flow.
Right. So I guess we'll leave that example with one of the, I think the free market economy is going to be as creative as possible with anything that turns out to be legal once this network exists, is I guess how I would summarize it.
Yeah, but beware of the secondary unintended consequences when you enable something that was carefully managed before and you put a hole in the dike, you may need the may not want the flood.
No, I completely understand because if I was creative enough to think of all those use cases, I would have 10 startup companies, but I don't. what about your health record bank example? Did we cover that?
So the specific, let me just be very specific, and I may be misremembering, but if you wanted to respond just for, you had this health record bank that you built with the consumer's permission, and you wanted to be able to respond for direct treatment queries as if you were a legitimate provider under covered entity, but you're not. You're a PHR building a health record bank. Are you allowed to do that? We understand you can consume the data, but are you allowed to share it back just for direct treatment? If that
only
makes sense, maybe I'm... Go ahead.
Yeah, right. So only if you're a covered entity or business associate with a relationship with that patient.
So specifically
for the treatment exchange purpose, it's limited to the HIPAA definition of treatment. So.
But would you have to be a HIPAA, an actual covered entity? Let's just take the health record bank, an independent health record bank. It's not a covered entity today because it doesn't process payments. Would it be allowed to be on the network and fetch the data on behalf of the consumer and then serve it back up to other providers in response to direct treatment queries with the consumer's permission, of course?
I think the answer is no unless it's the covered entity or the business associate operating on behalf of the covered entity.
So I would suggest that we recommend or consider a recommendation that that use case should be supported. I think the health record bank model has a lot of potential, and this could be the technical trick that makes it possible. And what I'm, you know, where I'm headed or what I'm thinking of is there are companies out there now that work on specific complex diseases like inflammatory bowel disease or multiple sclerosis. And they have built tools to assemble an extremely useful summary view of the patient's medical problems, which is way beyond what EHR vendors are offering because these things are highly specialized. And it would be really nice if they could plug into the network to fetch the data and then serve it back up for the PCP and others because they've created this incredibly valuable summary of the patient's medical conditions. That ought to be supported, it would seem to me.
So maybe it is, but
I just like clarity on.
And I see that we've captured that. My fault, we have a growing list of folks patiently with their hands up, starting with, looks like Mark Roche is on top.
Sure. And I'm trying to understand the workflow. What is the process? How do you envision, and whether you envision Kafka storing consents received from patients specifically pertaining to individual access services? Who should store that consent and how is it delegated and maintained?
Okay. So is that a question to ONC? I'm trying to think about that's different than meaningful choice in terms of how to constrain your data, or is it?
It's an open-ended question. I guess it's for up for discussion. I'm trying to get a better appreciation of the workflow. And if I, as a patient, request through TEFCA that my information be shared, or that I get a consolidated view of all of the information wherever it's available, I'm trying to understand first, where is my consent to share that data stored, whether the QHIN will store that or some other entity, or is it going to maintain within the institution that holds my record? And second, can I specify that only certain information within my health record, such as medications and allergies, could be shared, but maybe not lab?
So my understanding, I'll take a shot at stirring this pot a little bit, is so in terms of meaningful choice, it's all or nothing, in that a consumer can say, no, don't share my data, or do share my data, but that can't at this point, as drafted, be selective, as you suggested. What I'm struggling with is that's not the same as consent. And I'm can someone from ONC? I mean, we're going to have is consent even spoken to as a QHIN functionality?
Hey John, yeah. So I would ask. There's lots of different or. The word consent can be kind of confusing and misleading, and as you were alluding to before, there are several different versions of consent or approval or meaningful choice within the TEFCA. So rather than answering the specific question, because I think that the answer varies, I would point folks to the applicable language in the MRTC. So you have other in sections 6.1.4, 7.4, and 8.4, you have requirements. It says other legal requirements, and that refers to one type of consent or approval. There's the meaningful choice provisions. There's also the consent or approval, whatever you'll call it, under the permitted and future uses sections. That's 2.2.2. 7.2 and 8.2, and we can discuss the individual those individual sections, but that would be my recommendation.
Got it. Thank you. And not surprisingly, but you have an amazing command of this draft regulation. Okay, going down the list, Mark Savage has a question, and then Cynthia.
Several things. One is there's a couple of use cases that I didn't mention the first time that I'd just like to make sure we're all thinking about. And I've picked ones that are sort of within the current legal structure. One is the patient's right to submit corrections and amendments under the privacy rule. So that's, people sometimes think we can't do PVP, patient-generated health data, but that right of correction and amendment is a form of patient-generated health data that I think we should be building for. And the other is the Precision Medicine Initiative, all of us, the individual participation in that to both contribute data and to get results. Again, I think that's outside the definition of individual access services. But it would seem to be a use case that we would want to be building for. So wanted to add those to the list of things that I think are top of mind that to consider here. The other thing I wanted to throw out is on the ONC NPRM, we're talking about EHI export, which goes well beyond the US CDI, but we're only talking about US CDI here. And I'm a little curious about that. I don't know. It's not limited there, but limited here. Why the difference? To your point, John, as I understand where the individual is using it to get data, what they're going to get is the US CDI. They're not going to get the HIPAA designated record set back.
I thought I understood it in Alex's presentation, which is that was something I did not appreciate, is that it's limited to US CDI except for individual access services, in which case it's not. Did I understand that correctly?
I sure hope so. That's not what I understood.
A response to a query is limited to, or I shouldn't say limited to, because it's not a limit. It is the minimum obligation is to respond with all electronic health information in US CDI.
And that applies to all exchange purposes, including IAS.
I believe that's correct.
Okay, so Mark, you had it right. I had it wrong. Sorry to report, apparently.
Yeah, I think the editorial comment is that a minimum is not a limit. We're using limit in I think, two different ways. There is, what's the minimum that I need to do to meet my obligations under the TEFCA? That doesn't limit me to doing more than the TEFCA.
Certainly.
So what I would want to then flag for, if we're sticking within this construct and not making a recommendation that goes beyond it, what I would want to flag for conversation is what can we say about encouraging people to go beyond that, or a structure for doing that, so that there is at least some dirt road on-ramp for some things.
Yeah, so and we're capturing these comments, and I can't say what at this stage what might end up being in a set of draft recommendations for us to revisit
right
when we get there. Cynthia has been patiently waiting.
Thank you. This goes back a little bit to consent. And in the patient need for access to providing consent and to have various whole databases, have the comprehensive viewpoint into the patient, also in being able to pull that data, I do believe it's really important that the patient clearly understands what the patient is consenting to. I think we had someone from ONC talk through various types of consent, but I will tell you for a fact that some of the problems we're seeing with certain EHR vendors and installations, at least in the Boston market, is that even in the EHR system, a patient cannot leave a screen or even get care unless they sign the electronic iPad for consent. And the consent is merely a signature line, where even within the urgent care or even within the hospital system themselves, they're not provided the written description of what they are consenting to. We have various reports from various patients and families. We also see that what's being collected by the EHR vendors, even with adult children under the age of 26, in order to receive care, they have to complete a digital page, which includes alternative individuals to pay, that being the parents, and the parents' field of must fill also includes the parents' social security numbers, including the financial payment method if for balance billing. And one has even refused care without that being complete. So when we think about what's comprehensively being collected by certain providers, and this being comprehensively linked to family members' credit cards and social security numbers, I think it's really important that we look at the future of big data and the future of the opacity of patients understanding what's being collected behind them, and being able to have the ability to refuse to give financial identifiable information like social security numbers. I just want to raise this issue because when we also look at the sharing of the data, we've talked before about provenance, is oftentimes it's so difficult for the patient to get access of their complete electronic health information, and we know it's being shared multiplicatively behind the scenes. It would be very prudent as we look at this umbrella in the TESCA world to give patients the ability to opt out, to actually see a trail, and to check out of it being included elsewhere. There are applications that we would want to allow innovative mobile apps like Exist Today, Life 360, Fly My Friends have the ability for a patient, if you look at the ability to time out access to information, could be by the hour, it could be by the day, it could be by the week, but ultimately we would be best served if patients had control of who could see their data and who they want to share the data with. Rather than sort of a big brother approach, an AI approach all behind the scenes, but ultimately empowering the patient to control the privacy of their own care along with their secured relationship with their physicians. I just want to bring that up because I do believe that we need to look at the comprehensive use of this data and where the design can be problematic. Thank you.
Is there a specific shortcoming of as drafted, or is that just something you want to make sure ONC takes into consideration?
Well, I think we really need to take into consideration the ability for patient control and to privacy and access, and the ability to utilize technologies where the sharing of the information could be timed out or denied by the patient and shared to the appropriate caregivers, which may vary based upon circumstances and locations. I think we're best served if we flip this on its head and put the patient first. And so I think if we look at this drafting, I think it behooves all of us because, you know, most come from a point of view, whether it be provider, insurer, or EHR vendor, I think it really, we need to go 30,000 feet, flip it on its head, and take the position of the patient in the drafting.
Thank you. In an effort, we're coming up on public comment in about 6 minutes, so let's see if we can finish out at least IAS. There's one that I believe came up on our very first or second call, which is who has to respond to queries for IAS, and let me see if I can, this may be the if I remember correctly, a Noam Arts Memorial question in that. So if I'm a participant uses a QHIN of choice, and from that QHIN comes a request for an individual's access to their information, who has to respond to that? And the example that was given was, I believe, a public health authority, and I'm not sure if we clarified that. And do I even have the right scenario?
I recall Noam's not on the call, but I recall his concern was about whether public health would be obligated to respond. And his concern was that many public health entities aren't prepared to do so. That seems like a slippery slope to me.
Yeah.
So on the one hand,
small EHRs can't respond either. Does that mean they can't be EHRs anymore?
Yeah. Let's explore that. I see. Thank you. So if it's against the local if it's against state law for a public health authority to disclose that information, then they don't disclose it.
Right.
But if there is no law saying that they mustn't, are they required to respond to IAS queries?
Yes.
Anyone from? So we answered that one earlier, and the answer is yes, they are. question mark.
Yeah, that's the intent.
Okay. That does sound like it's going to be hard, knowing what we know about local health departments, et cetera. There was also some questions. Let me flip a couple pages here about did we address the question, must an IAS-only participant respond to all IAS queries? And the answer was yes. May IAS-only participants respond to other exchange purposes? And I guess the answer would be, well, then they're not an IAS-only participant. So any clarification from ONC? If you're IAS-only and you've somehow made the world known that that's what you are, you can't optionally respond to other exchange purposes, question mark?
Correct.
Thank
well,
you.
I think if you're a HIPAA covered under your business associate, then you can respond. You're just not required by the terms of the contract to respond.
Yeah, so the example of a health record bank that David keeps bringing up, the purpose is to hold data on behalf of the consumer. What I'm understanding is that they could be an IAS only responder, but they couldn't go one step beyond that and respond, for example, for treatment, because if they did that, then they'd be not an IAS only responder.
I'm going to have to think about that one, but for now, it seems to make sense.
Yeah, and I think that's a this is David. I think I have that as a concern that would limit a very useful kind of participant.
Yeah, and you know, as a consumer, I'd love to be able to delegate my iPhone that stores data on my behalf and allows me to really reasonable controls over what app can I access, what for what purposes. I'd love to be able to delegate that app to have Apple respond for me in certain circumstances, but not all, but it doesn't sound like that would be permitted. Because I'd be, in that case, not an IAS-only responder. Once I tiptoed over the line and I responded for a request for treatment purpose, suddenly I'd be in the all of the all or nothing or the all or limited.
And I would point out the logical inconsistency of that. You have a right to ask for everything but no right to share it back. That doesn't seem to make sense.
Well, as an individual, I have the right to access for everything, so that's fine. But
right, that works.
Yeah.
The other way, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
I want to be able to share it back. It's the PGHD, but in this case, I'm just talking about existing, provider-authored data that you want to clean up, summarize, organize to be useful for downstream providers. You should be able to share that back in some easy way. You can always send it in a direct message or whatever. There's other ways to do it, but it would be nice if it was naturally on the network.
So interrupting, sorry. Before we go to public comment, I just wanted to ask, have we finished the IAS category, or were there other write-in candidates that folks wanted to bring up for discussion? And then we'll go to public comment and circle back.
This is Mark. The only thing I can think of that maybe may come up is if we think that we want to write recommendations around particularly important use cases, but not for all use cases. So I don't know if you want to categorize the use cases that I've brought up that I think are more central than others, or whether you want to wait until we are discussing recommendations. That's all I can think of at the moment.
Thanks. I would say the way I was thinking about that was that you've made a good point that there are use cases we should consider, and you've offered some examples which are really helpful. Let's see how that comes out in draft recommendations, if it does, and we'll debate it then. With that, can we go to public comment?
Thanks, John. We'll just get the number pulled up here. Sorry, my computer froze, so I may be a little bit delayed.
It actually is displayed.
Okay. All right. So delay on my end. Operator, can we please open the public line?
If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
And do we have any comments in the queue?
Not at this time.
Okay. We'll check back on the comments before we adjourn. John?
Yes. And so, hey, Arian, can we sneak in one more section which only has one question, and it happens to be a question that I kind of championed, and it seems like it's a less than 8-minute discussion to knock that one off.
Oh, famous last words.
I'm tempting fate. We can take a shot at it, and if I, you can make fun of me if I turn out to be wrong. How about that?
Sounds good. That sounds super fair.
Okay, so this gets to Section 2.2.2 on permitted and future uses. And what I understood it to say, and Zoe can laugh at me when I botch this, is that so you can't do anything that's not for one of the exchange purposes except the following. So where I got wrapped up was the very last thing it says is you can do anything that the individual who's the subject of the data specifically says that you can do. So I'm like, okay, so if it's not on the permitted purposes list, I can ask the individual, and if they say yes, you can do that, and it meets all the requirements of the authorization, then I'm good. However, the point right before that in the list implies, it says that as otherwise permitted by applicable law, meaning I can do anything that is not against the law. So what I was trying to clarify, I read that as, and I'm not doing a very particularly articulate job of saying so, is I can do anything once we have the data that's been accumulated through normal exchange purposes. One of the things that I can do is anything that's not against the law. And another thing that I can do is anything that the individual says I can do. Is that right? Or do I need to reframe that question in a much more intelligible way?
That's right, except I don't know that I would phrase it as anything that's not against the law, so much as anything that's explicitly permitted by applicable law. So the example, or I guess the intent behind that that section is HIPAA permits all of treatment, payment, and operations. So you can reuse, disclose if you're covered under your business associate. Then you would be able to reuse, disclose, aggregate, et cetera, for all of treatment, payment, and operations.
Yeah, I think the go-to example here was research, and I should have come up with an additional one that was maybe not so safe. But the research example was, okay, well, some research you can't use the patient's data without their specific authorization, but some research can be conducted if it's de-identified data and there's an IRB, et cetera, et cetera. So I read this to say one of the permitted purposes for a QHIN is to use research as long as it doesn't require individual authorization. Is that a fair example?
This is
Catherine.
Sure.
I was going to say the only thing I would add to that is to the extent the requirements under HIPAA to use that purpose, to use the information for research are met, just like you just outlined.
Right.
You know, if it went through an IRB, if it's de-identified, things like that. That's what
and
I think
so
the
good
intent of applicable law would be.
And then, John, I've got some other examples. I've got some other examples for you that are non-research.
Please.
But if I wanted to donate my data, so I'll use sort of farious and nefarious. I've always been troubled that farious isn't a word. Examples. So if I wanted to donate my data as a patient with a rare disease in order to maximize treatment algorithms. I'm not sure if that's a research use or an operations use, but I could do so. If I wanted to, if I was a patient aggregating company that had a business model of selling data to pharma companies, that would be an example of something that is permitted but would require specific authorization in order to do so. So there's a wide range of activities that are not prohibited that are permitted under applicable law but are not one of the safe lane activities under HIPAA.
I guess what's helping me in this is that and the authors from ONC are going to say, duh, John, that's what it says. So I'm a QHIN. I've accumulated this data. I'm asking myself, what can I do with it without breaking any rules? It's the same things that you can do with it under HIPAA or any other applicable law that goes beyond HIPAA. If those restrictions do not apply, then it's permitted is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's correct. I think the applicable law has to apply to the entity that's in question.
Yeah, another way of saying it maybe is that TEF doesn't change any of the fundamental rules regarding what you can and can't do with patient data. It just says specific things of what you can use this network for.
So
yeah,
there's
floor, not a ceiling.
There seems to be, and we just have a minute, so I'm pushing my luck, but there seems to be this feeling evolving that QHIN is a thankless job nobody would want. And it seems to me that there may be some clever things that QHINs are going to be able to do to have business models to support their business.
Well, yeah, the way I put your answer, John, is that a QHIN is the outer boundary. So if you take IHIE, IHIE as a QHIN is the outer boundary of IHIE. The TEFCA says nothing about the inner boundary, except with response to cross QHIN exchange.
Right. Okay.
It doesn't create any new permissions that didn't exist before. We're not
or new restrictions that didn't exist before. Except with respect to Commonwealth or Care Quality or what have you, querying IHIE.
Got it.
Well, I mean, another way of saying it is those entities could continue to exist and totally ignore TEFCA and nothing in their world would change.
Right.
TEFCA hasn't changed any fundamental rules about data.
Right. It's intended to enable. Yeah, I guess my point is that it's really intended to, the outer boundary is what it's intended to enable, which is cross-network exchange and then certain obligations that are associated with cross-network exchange, but it has nothing to say about intra-network exchange, it has nothing to say about, in general,
right.
About the, it's a floor on the cross-network exchange, but doesn't have anything to say about other things that go beyond that, as long as they're explicitly authorized.
Yep, this is helping with my instincts.
All right,
we are
and we're definitely over time now.
01.
Yeah. Thanks all.
Okay, great. And just real quickly, our next meeting isn't until next Monday, June 3rd.
A little bit of a rest.
Take a breath.
Okay. Thanks
Bye-bye.
Very much.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
All right.